Hello, hello, and welcome to Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and the Oscars are just a few weeks away. So today on the show, we're bringing you an Oscars preview, running down each of the Best Picture nominees, plus a discussion with Arkansas filmmaker Andrew Camarillo about Best Picture nominee Minari. Don't go anywhere.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
I am the father.
You can't handle the truth.
Always do the right thing.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
The Oscars, live April 25th on ABC.
The Oscars are coming up on April 25th, marking what is essentially the end of the 2020 movie year. And what a strange year it was. Here in early 2021, vaccines are rolling out, movie theaters are reopening, and the world is beginning to come to some sort of new normal. Despite what an unusual year 2020 was, we did get some great films, and the Oscar nominations reflect that. For this Oscars preview, I'll run through each of the Best Picture nominees and give my brief thoughts on each. So let's get into it. Going alphabetically, the first Best Picture nominee is The Father. This is a film about an aging father and his daughter dealing with the effects of his dementia. I gave a full review back on episode 51 of the podcast, but what's unique about this film is that it puts us in the headspace of the lead character Anthony, played by Anthony Hopkins. So we experience the world just as Anthony does. It's a very confusing world, thanks to his mental condition. Hopkins does incredible work here, as does Olivia Colman as his daughter Anne. Both are nominated for acting Oscars as well. The moment I keep thinking about from this film comes when Anne is introducing her father to a new in-home caretaker. He's not taking it well. He's acting out. He's being very rude to everyone involved. Olivia Colman's performance in this scene is layered and heartbreaking as she is apologizing to their guest for her father's behavior. That's an Oscar-worthy performance for sure. Besides Best Picture, Best Lead Actor, and Best Supporting Actress, The Father is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Editing, and Best Production Design. The Father is now playing in theaters and on VOD. Next up, Judas and the Black Messiah. This one's based on the true story of Fred Hampton, who was chairman of the Black Panther Party in Chicago in the late 60s. He's played here in a magnificent performance by Daniel Kaluuya. The FBI, under director J. Edgar Hoover, wanted to silence Fred Hampton and infiltrated the Black Panthers using an undercover agent named Bill O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield. Both Kaluuya and Stanfield are doing remarkable work here, and both are nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Despite being set 50 years ago, this story has an incredible resonance today because of the divided nature of race relations, both then and now. A good deal of time is spent hearing ideals and arguments from Chairman Fred, and they seem to apply almost directly to 2021 America. That socially charged message is tied up in what's one of the best double agent thrillers that I've seen since The Departed, making this a really thoroughly memorable watch. The ending of this movie really took my breath away. Judas and the Black Messiah is also nominated for Best Original Song, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Cinematography. You can catch Judas and the Black Messiah in theaters now, or you can rent on demand at home. The Academy loves movies about movies, and this year's entry into that subgenre is Mank. Gary Oldman plays Herman Mankiewicz, the renowned screenwriter of Citizen Kane. David Fincher directed this film, which looks at the writing process of Citizen Kane, and it looks at Mankiewicz's complex relationships with just about everyone in Hollywood. There's some great recreations of classic Hollywood in this movie, including the presence of Marion Davies, who is played wonderfully by Amanda Seyfried. She's probably the best part of this film. And this film is also probably one of the least accessible of this award season. Critics were somewhat divided on it as well, though I quite liked it, with a few issues. I hashed all that out back on podcast episode 40. Rance Collins joined me for that episode, which was fascinating because he actually personally knows a member of the Mankiewicz family. Mank is the most nominated this year with 10 nominations. So it's got Best Picture, Best Lead Actor for Gary Oldman, Best Supporting Actress for Amanda Seyfried, Best Director for David Fincher, as well as Best Sound, Best Production Design, Original Score, Makeup and Hairstyling, Costume Design, and Cinematography. And Mank is now streaming on Netflix. Next up, Minari. Minari tells the story of a Korean-American family in the 1980s who moves to Arkansas to start a farm. The young son, David, is the protagonist here, and the film is based on the actual experiences of writer-director Lee Isaac Chung. The family goes through challenges relationally and financially, with much of the film focusing on the father character Jacob, played by Steven Yeun. In the second half of this podcast episode, I'm going to go in-depth about this film with my guest, Andrew Camarillo, so I'll save the rest for that. For now, I'll just say this film is very well made and very moving, and I'm thrilled that it's getting so much recognition this year. Apart from Best Picture, Minari is nominated for Best Lead Actor for Steven Yeun, Best Supporting Actress for Yeo Jung-yoon, who gives a wonderful performance as David's grandmother, Best Director for Lee Isaac Chung, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Original Score. Minari can be rented on demand, and it's still playing in some theaters. The next nominee is the wonderful Nomadland, directed by Chloe Zhao and starring Frances McDormand. For a variety of reasons, this film is the favorite to win, and I will have no complaints if that happens. The film follows Fern, whose life has recently changed in big ways outside of her control. Not only has she lost her husband of many years, but the mining town where they lived has been abandoned after economic collapse. She finds herself alone, living in her van, and without a job, and unsure what to do next. This is when she encounters the nomads. Fern falls in with a group of people who live in their vehicles and spend their lives traveling and working odd jobs. Director Chloe Zhao incorporates a number of real-life nomads as characters in the film and takes time to understand why they would choose this life. Over the course of the film, Fern grows friendships, experiences much of the natural beauty of the U.S., and struggles with whether she should try and settle down in a more traditional way. The film is remarkable. It's imbued with a sense of loneliness in some scenes that is almost overwhelming, but also joy in other scenes that I haven't felt often in a movie. So for all its strengths, for me, Nomadland is fantastic for just how emotionally complex it is as a film. Back in episode 41 of this podcast, I talked in depth about Nomadland with filmmaker Marty Lang, and he brought some wonderful insights about the film. So check that out for more, and you can stream Nomadland on Hulu or rent on demand. Nomadland is nominated for Best Picture, Best Lead Actress for Frances McDormand, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Film Editing, and Best Cinematography. Now let's talk about Promising Young Woman. What a potent film this is. Part revenge thriller, part social commentary, part soul-crushing drama, Promising Young Woman stars Carey Mulligan as Cassandra. A traumatic event in her past has inspired Cassandra to go on a revenge spree. She's targeting quote-unquote nice guys at bars who prey sexually on women under the guise of taking care of them. That setup is just where the story begins, though, and over time, we begin to understand that whatever happened to Cassandra has left her permanently scarred and unable to move forward in her life. Over the course of the film, Cassandra tries to trust again, while we learn, piece by piece, just what has happened in her past, all while she continues upping the ante with her brilliantly conceived revenge plots. All of this leads to an absolutely unforgettable final act, which really shows off the incredible screenwriting talent of writer-director Emerald Fennell. Another memorable aspect here is the film's style. It's got vibrant colors and bold music choices that give it this kind of unique blend of sickly sweet and forebodingly sinister. It's like a candy-coated Kill Bill, but with an important social message. Apart from Best Picture, Promising Young Woman is nominated for Best Lead Actress for Carey Mulligan, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. You can rent Promising Young Woman on demand now. Next up is Sound of Metal. This, my favorite film of 2020, stars Riz Ahmed as a metal drummer who suddenly loses his ability to hear. I just covered this film in depth a couple weeks ago in episode 51 with the help of filmmaker and musician Johnny Brannan. So I'll be brief here, but I love this film for the way it starts with a very specific premise and goes in unexpected directions. We end up learning a great deal about the deaf community, about sign language, and about the controversial treatments around hearing loss. And ultimately, the film is about the importance of holistic well-being and self-acceptance, especially in the face of enormous, devastating loss. This movie kept me guessing as to what in the world would happen next, and then it absolutely knocked me out with its ending. I strongly encourage you to watch Sound of Metal, available now on Amazon Prime Video. The film also received Oscar nominations for Best Lead Actor for Riz Ahmed, who is magnetic in this movie, Best Supporting Actor for Paul Raci, Best Sound, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. And last up among Best Picture nominees is The Trial of the Chicago 7. This is a courtroom drama from writer-director Aaron Sorkin. It follows a trial that took place in Chicago in the late 60s after the protest at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. At these protests, many different groups of protesters came together, and so the Chicago 7, which is the seven defendants in this case, range from hippies to college kids to middle-aged dads. The diversity of opinions of these characters creates really fertile ground for Aaron Sorkin to craft his signature witty dialogue full of ideas, just as he's made his whole career doing. And the cast is stacked. The film stars Eddie Redmayne, Sacha Baron Cohen, Mark Rylance, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and many more great actors. Of all the Best Picture nominees, this is actually the one I'm the most critical of. All in all, I like this film, but I feel like I have to take it with an Aaron Sorkin-sized grain of salt. I think Sorkin is a brilliant writer of dialogue and very deserving of his many writing awards, but he can tend to be a bit syrupy, a bit idealistic in his writing. There are moments here that go for emotional that really didn't work for me, and there were situations that didn't feel super believable, even though this is based on actual events. Also, I generally really like Sacha Baron Cohen, but I didn't really like him in this, and I think that may be the result of the script and maybe just poor casting. Even with those complaints, this is one of the better things I saw in 2020, and I'll still recommend it. I think if you're a big Aaron Sorkin fan, you will love this. And I do consider myself an Aaron Sorkin fan, but I'd rewatch, say, any episode of The West Wing before I rewatch this. Trial of the Chicago 7 is also nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Sacha Baron Cohen, Best Original Screenplay, Best Film Editing, Best Cinematography, and Best Original Song, and you can watch it right now on Netflix. And that's all the Best Picture nominated films this year. If you want to hear my thoughts on any of the other categories, I did a live video on Instagram a few weeks back, and that is available on IGTV. I'll link it in the show notes. Find the whole list of nominations on Oscars.org and tune in to the Oscars on Sunday, April 25th on ABC. I'm also planning to record an Oscars reaction special with Rance Collins, who is an expert in all things Oscars and is basically a walking encyclopedia of movie history. The plan is for that to come out the day after the Oscars on Monday, April 26th.
May I have the envelope, please?
And the Oscar for Best Picture is presented to...
And the Oscar goes 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 to...
And the Oscar goes...
And the Oscar goes...
And the Oscar goes to...
The Oscar goes to...
The Oscar goes to...
And now for the main event. Today, we're talking about Minari, the Best Picture nominated film about a Korean-American family that starts a farm in 1980s Arkansas. This is an intensely personal story from writer-director Lee Isaac Chung, who based the screenplay on his own childhood. I'll break down the plot in more detail with today's guest. And my guest today is my friend and filmmaker Andrew Camarillo. Andrew has a great mind for cinema, and it's always a pleasure to talk to. He was the guest for a whole season of the podcast back when we looked at the Art House Starter Pack. In that season, we looked at some of the great art house films like Tokyo Story, Stalker, The Tree of Life, Vagabond, and Andrew was there every step of the way to deep dive into those with me. I'm so happy to have him back on this show, an Arkansas filmmaker to discuss an Arkansas film. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew Camarillo. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's been a while. I guess it's probably since we talked about art house movies a couple seasons back, but I knew I'd wanted you back soon. So glad you're here, and I'm excited to talk about Minari with you. And it was one that I think when I was looking at 2020 movies, of course, Minari was originally going to come out sometime last year and was delayed. And This was going to be one you were on to talk about, being an Arkansan, and just seemed like a good fit. So I'm excited to talk with you about it and to have you back. But before we get into that, what have you been watching lately? Anything else interesting?
Yes. So I've watched a few movies recently. I watched a film called Black Girl, which is a 1966 film from Senegal by Ousmane Sembène. And it was really incredible. I had never seen any of his work, but it's sort of like a post-colonial film about a woman who is hired on as a nanny or like someone to take care of the children from this French couple. And when she moves to move in with them and take care of the children, it's actually they've almost hired her on as like do-it-all housekeeper, cleaner. Wow. But it sort of explores her experience. It's, I think it's a great kind of dramatic and kind of almost tragic. It's a tragic work, but it was really good. So I enjoyed that. And I also watched Muyarengabo, which is like the filmmaker Lee Isaac Chung, who directed Minari. It's his first feature. Yeah. And I thought it was excellent. It's about a friendship between two Rwandan boys, one Hutu, one Tutsi, and sort of their relationship after the genocide in Rwanda. So, yeah, those were great. And also, I watched this for the first time, and it was really fun. Ghost Dog by Jim Jarmusch.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to watch that, yeah.
Yeah, so that was really great. And then the last two things, Green for Danger, 1946, like mystery thriller with my mom. It was really fun. It stars Alistair Sim. Nice. And then the 1967 animated Jungle Book. That's one of my favorite animated films.
Yeah, so, yeah. I watched that in a long time, probably since I was a kid.
It's really good. You should see it again.
I wanted to ask, is Lee Isaac Chung's, so it's Muyarengabo, is that streaming anywhere or did you rent it or something?
It's on Tubi or Tubi. It's free. I think there are only a few times there were like advertisements for like a minute, but it didn't cost anything, so it was nice to see. And actually, I think Roger Ebert called it a masterpiece when he was alive. So, I thought it was really good. It's actually made, it was made when he was in Rwanda, with, a group of teenagers sort of who he was teaching a film class there while his wife was doing volunteer work in Rwanda. And they had a big part, he says, in creating the story and explaining to him actually the culture there. Of course, him not being a native there or originating from there. So they had a big part in actually developing the story and also just like the realism in the film. But I thought it was excellent, so I highly recommend it.
That's great. Yeah, I'm trying to make time for that. That sounds really great. Let's see. I'm trying to think what else I've been watching lately. I watched several things. Let's see. I told my wife, I think I need just a morning off. I'm stay-at-home dad right now, which I'm loving, but I need a break here and there. So I said, can I have like a half day and just go in the office and watch movies? And that's what I did. So I ended up watching, I had just seen all of Small Axe, the Steve McQueen series, which I think is great. And there's a few of his films that I hadn't ever watched before. So I went back and watched Hunger and then also Shame. Hunger I liked better out of those two. Both were really, really good, I think. Hunger was really intense. I mean, both of them are really intense, but Hunger especially. Have you seen Hunger before?
I haven't.
It's very bleak and very rough. It's about a hunger strike in an Irish prison. It's kind of here's a piece of history that should be more widely known kind of thing. Like this was a human rights violations kind of thing. But it's just incredibly well made. He's got a great eye for cinematography and he's really become one of my favorite, I think, kind of living directors. So I'll recommend Hunger, but it's not for the faint of heart. It was heavy. And then Shame is really good too. It's Michael Fassbender's in both of those films. And Shame is about he and his sister, played by Carey Mulligan, and it's more modern day, basically going through a lot of issues, and namely he is a sex addict, and it paints that and obviously the heaviness that it deserves. And it's a heavy movie too, but I do think out of the two I probably prefer Hunger just a little bit, but both.
And what year was Hunger made?
Hunger was 2008.
Okay.
And yeah, then Shame, it was 2011. And then after that, it was 12 Years a Slave, whenever that year was, 2016 or something like that. And then Widows, which I think is a good movie too. It's more of a blockbuster style movie. It's a heist movie, but it's solid. I think it's really good too. So I watched some Steve McQueen stuff. And then I had never watched The Passion of Joan of Arc, the 1928 film.
So by Dreyer?
Yes.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah.
And kind of learned about how there's different cuts. And at that time period, you could run film at different speeds. So you can watch it in different speeds, and it kind of gives it different vibes. Different soundtracks have been created for it. So yeah, really interesting, really, really moving, and yeah, visually groundbreaking. Which, I mean, if anyone's heard of that movie, they know that that's the kind of the thing about it, is that these close-ups of her face and other characters too, but Joan especially. But yeah, just a really interesting look at the kind of religious dogma of the time and how greatly it affected people. So that was interesting. And then I wanted to mention, I also, the last time you were on, I think we were talking about The Tree of Life. And since that time, I watched the extended cut, which is on the Criterion disc, and it was good. I really like it. It's long. It's over 3 hours, just a little over 3 hours. So it took a couple sittings, but it adds a lot of interesting context. Extended family. Actually, we get a lot of Jessica Chastain's mother and brother come to visit at certain times. And then we learn a little bit more about Brad Pitt's father. So the kid's grandparents, I thought there might be more to the opening sequence with all the, you know, creation of the universe stuff, but that's pretty much the same, I think. And most of the things were just some more vignettes kind of with the family. There's a whole section where the main character is sent off to boarding school, and that none of that was there. So it really does add a lot of interesting stuff. I think it didn't have a hugely different effect than the theatrical cut. So if time is a consideration, I would say just watch the regular one. But if you're a big fan of this movie, like I am, it's definitely worth watching. So yeah, that's awesome. Tree of Life extended cut, which I think is only on the Criterion disc, but yeah, cool. A few other things, but I'll wrap it up there. Oh, we'll mention one more. Actually, this is a kind of a fun one I watched with, the kids, Kiki's Delivery Service. It's one of the Studio Ghibli animated films. And I've seen probably five or six of those out of all the ones they've made, but this one was really sweet and really cute. And I really liked a lot, and my kids seem to enjoy it as well. But it tells the story of a witch, a friendly witch who, she's young and she can ride her broom and everything, or she's still kind of learning. She's not great at it, but she decides to use this to be a delivery person. So she delivers stuff for this bakery and for other people too. Anyway, it's just a sweet, cute little movie. We watched the American dub because I was with my kids, and you know, I typically would prefer doing subtitles and listen to the Japanese, but it was actually a solid dub. It has Phil Hartman as one of the characters. He's the cat, and yet, so it's just funny hearing his voice come out of this like tiny cute little cat, and he's saying these kind of droll things. It's really a fun experience. And yeah, all the Studio Ghibli stuff is on HBO streaming now, so that's it's easy to get to those. So yeah, I've tried to watch a couple of those in the last little bit. Anyway, that can be enough of what I've been watching, but yeah, it's been some good stuff here lately. All right, well, let's talk about Minari.
What a wonderful day to be in the house of the Lord. If you're here with us for the first time, please stand. What a beautiful family. Glad you're here.
How's your daddy like that new farm? He growing things good, doing things right?
Yes.
미국 애들은 할머니랑 같이 방 쓰는 거 싫어한다던데.
But I don't like grandma.
쟤는 안 그래요. 한국 애니까.
Grandma smells like Korea.
야, 뭐라고? Grandma smell?
Mm. 우리 여기 있다가 망할 거야. 애들을 위해서라도 한 번 더 생각해 볼 수 있잖아.
애들도 한 번쯤 아빠가 뭔가 해내는 거 봐야 될 거 아니야.
있잖아, 이놈아.
할머니는 진짜 할머니 같지 않아요.
할머니 같은 게 뭔데?
쿠키도 만들고, 나쁜말도 안 하고, 먼저 팬티도 안 입고.
We need to find water somewhere. If that soil ain't wet, we're gonna lose a crop.
Pretty boy, pretty boy.
I'm not pretty, I'm good looking.
All right, let's talk about Minari. So this is a film directed by Lee Isaac Chung. It stars Steven Yeun, and it's about a family, a Korean family that comes to Arkansas. The Korean American family comes to Arkansas to start a farm, and they've moved from California, but they're kind of starting a new chapter, a new life, a little bit. And Steven Yeun's character's name is Jacob. His wife is Monica. She's not so thrilled about the new situation. They have two kids, David and Anne, and David is sort of the main character here. The at least we kind of see things through his perspective. He's played by Alan Kim, and he's sort of a stand-in for the director, because the director, Lee Isaac Chung, has talked about, you know, this very much is based on his childhood experiences. And so they're living in Arkansas and kind of a remote area. It's starting a farm and kind of going through the struggles that come with that, and also kind of experiencing the culture of Arkansas, and which is really interesting as an Arkansan to see. But it's just really, it's pretty low key movie, but it's beautifully made. It's an A24 film, which A24 has sort of a cult following these days, and this, I think, you know, will not disappoint for anyone who's a big A24 fan. But yeah, that's kind of the basic setup, and it kind of goes through a period of life where they're beginning this farm, and the husband and wife, basically their relationship is struggling to some degree, and that's kind of a big thrust of the story, as well as just kind of coming of age and father-son relationship stuff is all happening all at once. And then also there's a kind of a wrinkle comes when their grandmother moves in, and she's an interesting character. We'll talk about her, but David, the main character, the young boy, doesn't like her for a while, and then they have a contentious relationship, and that's an interesting part of the movie as well. But yeah, that's kind of the basic setup. This just came out, and it was a 2020 film, but it was not released until a few weeks back here in 2021. But I think it is eligible for, you know, 2020 Oscars and all of that. But yeah, that's Minari. I was going to ask you, Andrew, kind of what did you think of this film generally? And then I wondered if being an Arkansas native, did that affect your viewing of this film at all, and how?
Overall, yeah, I thought it was excellent. I really enjoyed the film. And yes, like living in Arkansas, being from here, and watching the film has been, it was interesting, to see the depiction from the point of view of, a director who grew up here, but also is a Korean American, and mm-hmm. his family, their experience with moving to, I guess, rural America and navigating that experience. I think I may have had some preconceptions that potentially the depiction of rural Caucasian Americans or Arkansans, I mean, are going to be depicted in a certain way. But actually, I felt like Lee Isaac Chung engaged the family engaged with the Arkansans in a way that felt like it wasn't a caricature of an Arkansan, mm-hmm. Caucasian Arkansan. It was mm-hmm. different. And I thought in interviews with him after the film, Jeff Nichols, I think, did an interview with him,
Q&A. I watched the Arkansas Cinema Society did a screening, digital screening, and then had a conversation with Jeff Nichols. Yeah, I was going to mention something from that too, but go ahead.
It's sort of, Lee spoke to, he experienced some racism, of course, but also he felt like he was part of the town in Lincoln where he grew up. So I think there was a bit of like empathy and sort of like compassion with the engagement with like, you know, Native Arkansans at the time there. So I think the depiction wasn't what I exactly thought. And I felt like the film was maybe better because of it, because it seemed as though Lee felt a part of being an Arkansan himself when he was growing up. I think he moved there when he was around two or three. So
yeah,
it's a different experience than like, okay, look at, like I expected it to be a bit more harsh in its portrayal, not harsh, but actually maybe some may say realistic. I'm not sure, but it didn't have a tone that was aggressive or like resentful. So
yeah, no, I agree completely. Yeah, after that screening where Jeff Nichols was talking to him, Jeff Nichols said, you know, basically, you know, I kept expecting something to happen along those lines, some big racial problem happening, but it doesn't really. There's a moment where another boy at church says something, why are your eyes like that, or something, you know,
why like is your face flat, or something,
yeah,
like
something
that,
like that, and then I think he says, I don't know, and then they just kind of go on and they're friends, you know, that's really as extreme as that kind of stuff gets. And I like that too. It's you know, I think it could be good either way, right? But it reminds me of kind of looking at like films made by African Americans. There's this tendency that the things that win awards tend to be the ones about, you know, slavery or like the racial struggles and that kind of thing. And there's a growing movement to say, let's celebrate Black joy. Let's like celebrate things that are not the problems. You know, it seems like we can only win awards if we're making these heavy movies. So I thought that's in a similar way. You know, you might go into this expecting an Asian family in Arkansas. That's not going to be good, but that's not at all what happens here. And it's actually just a really lovely movie. And so I like that too. I think that's an interesting choice to set it up that way. But yeah, I think too, the being an Arkansan, watching this is, I always enjoy that kind of thing. 'Cause, you know, I know these locales. This feels very familiar, even though this was actually filmed outside of Tulsa. I saw in an interview. It definitely feels like Arkansas, and they're referencing towns and stuff. Then I'm like, yeah, I know exactly where that is. I could get there in a couple of hours if I wanted. So that was fun. And honestly, it made me kind of look more kindly on Arkansas a little bit. I think like there can be a tendency to want to distance yourself from where you grew up or something, and think about the problems that were there in your hometown. But I think this movie has a lot of compassion for the Arkansans, and there are definitely things that I'm just thinking about scenes where like they're in the church and you can just feel how fish out of water they feel in that setting, and how odd. So there's this man that helps them on the farm, and he's just an odd character, but yet feels like someone you'd really meet. And he's based on a real person, Lee Isaac Chung said in that interview as well. So there is such a difference there, but it's not a problem, right? And I think that's a cool way to make this. But then things too, like there's a scene where there's a tornado coming, and they live in a trailer, and he's like, yeah, he says, if that tornado comes, this house will be blown away, like something like that. And there's definitely familiarity in wanting to, you know, as a kid, having to hide in the hallway, and do we need to put a mattress over us, that kind of stuff. They're just living in Tornado Alley. There's kind of you don't see that depicted too often in films. So that's part of living in Arkansas. So that felt familiar as well.
Yeah, definitely. And for a family who's not from like this region to move in, and then I think he said within like the first week or a few days, like they experienced a tornado warning or watch of some kind. And the idea that, oh, this like cyclone in the air could like destroy, kill us is very like alarming for a child. And that would be like, would resonate in your memory, I think. So, yeah.
I remember thinking that when I was a kid, when I learned how prevalent tornadoes are, like, why does anyone live here? And I was like, well, in California they have earthquakes, and like you can't get away from those things entirely. Anyway, I thought that was a nice touch to bring that in. But then I thought too, Well, this, we'll talk about the father-son stuff in a minute, actually. That's kind of where I was going to go. So, yeah, let's get into that. A big part of this film is kind of those familial relationships, kind of father-son, and then the son and the grandmother, and then the father and mother, their marriage is a big part. But I want to see, did you find any of these relationships particularly moving, and anything you want to say about those?
Well, I think the grandmother's role in the film, with the dynamics with the grandchildren and her daughter, mm-hmm. and her son-in-law was really interesting. And I thought it was beautifully acted as well. The son, David, he is very uncomfortable with his grandmother coming because mm-hmm. it seems as though his parents are fighting about her in some way. Like he links his grandmother with tension between his mom and dad.
Yeah.
And when she arrives, she doesn't appear like what he thinks of as a grandma that like bakes cookies and is yeah. like very kind. She's sort of very invigorated and intense, but she's nice, but she has this personality that's not what I guess David's yeah. expecting from what he thinks of as a grandmother. But she brings a lot of energy and fun and liveliness to the family. And also she encourages David. And I don't think we've mentioned yet that David has a heart murmur. Mm-hmm. And I think that it in some way inhibits him from like, it's not like I think a huge part of the film, but it is part of the film where he feels limited. He gets a sense that from his mother and that he needs to be careful. He doesn't need to overexert himself, but mm-hmm. his grandmother sort of encourages him to just live his life and not to be as scared or as worried. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. I really like her character in the film.
Yeah. His mom and dad are constantly saying, don't run, David, don't run. You can't run because of your heart. And then she shows up and says, like, you're stronger than you think. You can do these things. And it's a really, really sweet thing too. Yeah. I like the grandmother a lot. There's a scene where, and this is in the trailers and stuff, but David says, you're not a real grandma. A real grandma doesn't swear or wear men's underwear. And as they bake cookies and like, so just this idea of what a grandma is, in the culture that he's living in, you know, that she doesn't fit that mold. But then there's another nice touch when she first shows up and it kind of, I thought this was a good way to show his discomfort. He says, grandma smells like Korea. And he means that in a negative way. So not only is that like a visceral kind of, you know, scent tied with memory, like you can understand what he means there. And I just thought that was a nice way to tie it in, but also adds this interesting layer of being a Korean American and like smelling like Korea is such a, you could see that as a very offensive thing someone could say, you know, and yet here he is saying it about his grandmother. And so I thought that was an interesting way to display that. But then also there's like kind of a interesting religious theme throughout this. It's not a huge part of the movie, but there is, so they go to church and they're the only, non-white people at church. And, then his mother, David's mother, a few times has, moments where she's telling him, oh, if you pray for this, if you pray for that, then maybe your heart will be healed or different things. If you're upset, if you pray about this. And the grandma really pushes back on that in a few moments and says, like, you don't have to do that. Like, that's not going to make a difference. And I don't know. I thought it was an interesting, like, I think I'm always interested in when religious themes are, kind of pulling a child this way and that, but it's another way that he really, I think, begins to feel close to his grandmother. And I like that aspect of the film as well.
Yes. Yeah. I think that, did you want to talk a little bit more about the religious elements now or later?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I agree. His grandmother seemed to comfort him when he was like worrying about potentially going to hell. And she's like, why are you concerned about that's like, you shouldn't be thinking about those things now. And she was really like comforting to him and supportive of him when his mother means well, of course, but, I don't think she's as aware that it's causing him some anxiety and stress. Mm-hmm. I thought his father's friendship with the
kind of farmhand guy. I'm looking at
Paul. Yeah. So his relationship with him is interesting because the father seems of like all the family, maybe, to be a bit, maybe less religious in mm-hmm. some way or less, I don't know, involved in that.
Yeah.
But the man he works with, the Arkansan he works with, seems to be sort of, I'm not sure how to describe, but I guess kind of he is very kind and open to friendship with Jacob, but also he is a religious, like evangelical or fundamentalist of some kind, I guess.
Yeah,
like,
maybe even you could call him a zealot or something. I'm not sure.
Zealot, yeah.
He has some interesting ideas and practices.
Yes, right. That are
above
right.
And maybe, beyond maybe a normal churchgoer. I don't know.
That's true. Maybe mysticism or something.
Yeah, something, yeah.
Something, right. So I just was going to say that it seems as though there is still compassion and like connection mm-hmm. between these people from very different backgrounds and very different experiences. And initially when he meets this man, the father, he's handed some Korean money, like war money, I guess, mm-hmm. or like maybe before the war, the Korean War. And I think this was like moving to him that the man just like gives him this or gives it to his son, mm-hmm. David, and just says, hey, I know when I met you, we were going to be friends, basically. And they do have a very considerate relationship and friendship. And Lee Isaac Chung, like, as you said earlier, it's based off of this character is based off of someone who is friends with his father. And despite their differences, they seem to be wonderful friends and supportive of each other. And I thought that was a really interesting dynamic mm-hmm. as well, related to religions. And at one point you see the character walking with a cross, like dragging it down the road, and the family drives by and they ask, hey, do you need a ride? And the and they're kind of like, what is going on here? We're very confused. But at a different point, I think you see a church van with like kids in it, and they go by and they say one of the Arkansan kids, Caucasian Arkansan kids, says something like derogatory about that man,
mm-hmm.
And just kind of like treats him as like he's just, you know, trash and garbage or something, where the Korean family is actually really kind and compassionate to him, even though they probably understand that he may have some potentially even like, you know, psychological mm-hmm. difficulties or problems.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really telling. That the immigrants are the ones actually like reaching out to those in the society that may be the most marginalized.
Something about being on the outskirts kind of fosters that empathy in a way.
Right.
I think it would be easy for a movie about with a character like Paul to make him more of a joke or something like that, but it really doesn't. Like it depicts exactly what he's doing, but he's even a source of humor in a few moments, but not in a way that's at his expense, really. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really a nice empathetic way to include that. Yeah, that's a good point. I really like the father-son relationship too, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit, but there's a lot of great moments there where, so David, I mean, the film opens on David's face, and so it kind of from the beginning, you know, like this is going to be his perspective, and they're pulling the moving van to the new house, and there's just a lot of moments where like dad is out farming and teaching his son different things. You don't pay for anything you can't get for free. And they're trying to find water in the ground instead of paying someone to build a well for them. And just kind of trying to instill lessons there. And it's a sweet relationship. As complicated of a relationship as David probably ends up having with his father, especially as he's kind of as the mother and father begin to have more tension, and the kids are kind of obviously having some issues around that, I think the father-son relationship is strong. There's even I like that they brought this into that, like David is supporting his father in some ways too, not just the other way around. There's a part where he's kind of asking his son for affirmation about moving. And he says, he's kind of fishing and he's like, well, California had these problems, right? When we lived there and it wasn't great. And he's just like, yeah, sure, dad, it wasn't great. And, you can tell he kind of feels better about, like he's questioning the decision to some degree and, starts to feel better about it. And then he even says, tell your mom that you like it here, you know?
Yeah, right. Using his son in some way to like have some influence with, his wife. Yeah. I thought that was really good. And also, in that same scene, I think he says something like, because I don't like he and his wife are chicken sexers. They kind of go through to see, like, distinguish between the male and female chickens. And in that same scene, he speaks to his son, and he's telling his son, like, you know, male chicks, I guess, are not useful. And there's an image of, like, the smoke, I guess, you know, potentially, I guess, killing the animals. The male chicks who can't lay eggs and can't do much. And he says, we need to be useful. And I actually thought that was really interesting and telling, and potentially may in a subtle way relate to immigrants who come to America who are male, may, you know, from certain societies may feel a pressure to, I need to do this. I need to have a job. I need to create a business. I need to do something because potentially it may be in their mind that also female people from their country may be just taken as, let's say, brides or wives to American men already, something like that. So the males may have to, this isn't said or stated, but it felt like that to me. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely thought it was interesting from, like, wondering about, like, a feminist aspect on this film and wondering how that would fit in. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense too. And I think that's kind of related to just in general, like, capitalism is all over this movie as it's driving the father to try to, like, make it, you know, in this way for better or worse. And I think it's just kind of depicting and letting you kind of draw your own conclusions from how all that's going. But you can see the pressure it puts on him and then on his marriage, on his whole family, that he feels like he has to, you know, be this self-made man and kind of follow the American dream in a lot of ways. So yeah, that's an interesting part of this movie as well. And then, yeah, I guess we can talk about the marriage a little bit, because it's an interesting part that kind of carries through. And I think we can avoid spoiling anything about the end of this movie. But it does have, you know, I say it's a pretty low key movie. That's true. But it does have a pretty climactic ending as well. From the very moment that they arrive at home at this new house, you can sense that the mom is not happy. Her name is Monica, played by Yeri Han. I think her performance is really good. We'll talk about performances in a minute, but she shows up and she says, "What is this place?" Like, looking at their new home, and he's like, "This is our house." And then they go inside, and she says, "It just gets worse and worse." And so it's funny, but it's also telling, you know, of the tension that's going to grow there. And then when Grandma shows up, she makes some comment too about, what happened to you guys? Used to be more lovey-dovey. It's like you've forgotten everything. And I thought it was an interesting and kind of poignant observation on her part. And then there's a scene I really like too, where it's kind of later in the film, but I can't remember exactly what they're having some conflict around this and having a serious discussion. And in that same moment, he's worked so hard in the farm that he can't use his arms. He's in the bathtub. And he's like, "I can't wash my hair. Will you wash my hair for me?" And so even in the midst of this argument and this conflict they're having, she does this tender thing and kind of washes his hair. And you can feel there is a tenderness still there despite the marital problems they're having. I thought it was a really nice scene. But do you have any thoughts about the marriage stuff?
The scene you just spoke of, I think he says something like, "Working outdoors makes me feel alive." And he was saying, "I'll take care of us." And she's like, "We're losing a lot of money here." And he says something like, "I came here for us. If this fails, you can do what you want and leave with the kids." You know, he says that kind of in passing. And, you know, it's just like a shot of her kind of looking at him, but also continuing to wash his hair. And there are moments like that throughout the film that I think are really well acted and really well written, that are subtle, delicate, but they provide a lot of information.
Yeah, like that's a big thing to say, but it's delivered in kind of an understated way.
Right.
Like he's almost casual about it, but you know that's coming from his own insecurity about everything probably too. Yeah, it's really well done and well acted.
Yes, the relationship, and there are several conversations throughout the film where between the husband and wife that are, I think, just so well done, and there's a lot of emotion in these conversations, and I think a lot of exposing and vulnerability being displayed. And sort of, as you were saying earlier, the idea of the American dream, or the dream to provide for one's family and, like, be successful at a business or something, sort of clouds his relationship at times with his family, or maybe puts it in jeopardy in his wife's perspective. And I think there are only a few conversations, I guess, directly about those things really are I don't know, have an emotional weight and resonance. Mm-hmm. So I like those a lot.
Yeah, I agree. And then that might be a good transition to talking about the performances here, because I think they're all pretty strong. Is there anything that any of the performers that really stood out to you?
I think, again, like the grandmother was excellent. And then mm-hmm. Mother, Monica, the actress, she's just so, I felt like it is, and a lot of times understated, but it's so well done. And it's powerful that her role, she's not the central figure in the film, but when she is present and has something to say or do, and like even her concern on her face, a few things happen in the film that, you know, are tragic, but she has these, or alarming, I guess. And she mm-hmm. has these moments where she's looking at her children or looking at her husband, and she's like, I think she acts very well without saying very much throughout mm-hmm. the film. And I'm a big fan. And the grandmother is just, I feel like, her character or her acting as this character is just wonderful, and it kind of ties the film together. And I think she's a central figure for me as far as the heart of the film.
Yeah, I agree with that. So she's played by Yoo Jung Yoon. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And actually, so I was looking at the Southeastern Film Critics Association, which is a group of film critics kind of from this region. She won Best Supporting Actress this year.
Oh, awesome.
They just announced their awards the other day. So I was looking at that. But and very well deserved. I think you're right. I think it's kind of a brilliant stroke, I think, just on the script level to say, okay, here's the family. We're going to set it up and kind of introduce everyone in this new situation. And then about a third of the way in, I guess, we bring in Grandma and the way she makes observations about the family and the way she affects everyone in the family is really interesting, and it's just a great way to add some wrinkles to the story as everything is developing. But yeah, she's really great. And again, we won't spoil anything maybe that happens, but her performance also takes a turn that's really interesting. And I think it's really well done as well. But yeah, just the dynamic she has with David especially is just really special, and it feels authentic. I think Stephen Ewan as Jacob, as the father here, is really great as well.
Yes.
Again, it's pretty understated. I mostly know him from The Walking Dead. He's a pretty major character on that. And he actually, at the beginning of The Walking Dead, he's very young. And so we kind of see him grow over the years. And so now he's playing this father figure, which is interesting because that show has been on forever now, it seems like. But he's really great in this, and he's... not the strong silent type exactly, but he's not especially vocal, but he when he speaks up, it's understated in a way that feels real. I think it's a really great performance from him. He has a line. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, and I read that his father in real life is moved from Korea to Minnesota and had to change his life. He was an architect in Korea, and when he moved to America, they had to start from scratch, sort of. And he said that playing this role helped him kind of close the gap sometimes in some way between he and his father. And his father actually got to see the film with him, the premiere, I guess, at Sundance. And it was very emotional for both of them. And I think he does an excellent job in this film. And I think for him, it was a bit of, in a personal way, really revelatory, I think, from what I read. So
that's fascinating. Yeah. Another little piece of trivia there is that Stephen Ewan is married to Lee Isaac Chung's sister, I believe. I think that's correct.
I think that's right. That's really incredible.
And that she's from Arkansas. I mean, obviously, Lee Isaac Chung is from Arkansas as well. So yeah, just interesting connection there. But then I wanted to mention another line that I really like from Jacob is it's towards the beginning as well, when he's kind of trying to make a case for why he's moved their family here. And they're looking at the dirt, and she's like, "What's the big deal with the dirt?" And he says, "This is the best dirt in America." And I love the conviction with which he delivers that. And it's a funny line, but it's also, I think this movie, just in general, the humor in this movie is so understated and subtle. Like, that's a funny line, but also poignant, and, you know, it also shows, you know, their motivations. And I just think the script is really, really great for that reason. But then I want to mention Alan Kim as David, as well as the young actor here. What do you think about his performance?
Oh, I thought both of the kids were great. Yeah. I thought they did a really good job. And I believe it was the first time acting in a film. So
I think that's right from what I've heard about him as well.
Yeah. I thought it was really, really good. I'm not sure how they did that, but it seemed like they had acted for a while, even though they're young. So.
Yeah, like he seemed pretty experienced. Yeah, I don't know if it's – I was trying to think like among child performances – is it a total standout? Maybe not, but I think it's really, really good.
Yes.
Yeah. If I'm looking at his IMDb now, there's nothing else. There's something coming up, but nothing before this. So yeah, that's really impressive. And the movie asks him to do so much. I mean, he's the central character in a way, but it's kind of one of those things where he's more observing things and we're kind of learning about things. Although a lot of the story involves him as well. So anyway, yes. Good performance out of him. Is there any other aspects of this film or any elements of this film that we haven't talked about that you want to mention that you connected with?
The relationship the children had with the grandmother, I think, was really interesting. It doesn't mirror my relationship with my grandmothers, but the grandmother does feel quite a bit older in some way. I'm not sure, you know, she's depicted in that way, but from a different generation, a different culture from David himself. Yeah. Kind of seeming to grow up there in America, he speaks English. It feels as though that she was very influential, and we haven't spoken about that, where the title comes from.
Yeah,
Minari.
Okay with that, yeah.
The grandmother sort of planting the vegetable Minari down near this creek bed, and sort of going David and his grandmother going there together and kind of navigating and exploring this region alone, sort of away from the parents, away from his sister, where they develop this sort of intimate bond, where he grows closer to her, even though at first he feels unsure and uncomfortable about her as someone in his life.
Yeah.
I really liked that part of the film. And she sings a song at some point about Minari, or and she both sing together about how Minari is so wonderful and so tasty. And I thought that was just very beautiful. Those are very delicate touches that work, and I don't think they're overly sentimental. And I think this film could have, because it's in a way autobiographical, could have fallen into this maybe too much sentimentality, but I don't think it does.
Yeah, I was surprised at just how not sentimental it is. And I think like wide audiences might not appreciate it as well for that reason. Like, I think it's finding an audience for sure, but you know, you could see this being a much bigger, you know, have a more sweeping score, or like written in a way that has all these huge emotional beats, and it doesn't have that, but I think it's stronger for it. I agree. And so a little more trivia stuff that I didn't know until watching interviews just about the plant Minari itself. I mean, I didn't even know that was a plant. You know, I didn't know what the title meant until watching this, but Lee Isaac Chung explained in an interview that it's a plant that you kind of put where nothing else will grow. It adapts to its region in a way. So you can kind of see some symbolic things there, looking at this Korean family. But then also, it tends to cleanse. Like if you put it near water, the water is going to become more drinkable and more inhabitable for wildlife. It sort of has a cleansing effect on the region that it's in, which I think is really interesting too. And then one other thing he mentioned about it was that you usually plant the first round and then kind of discard it, and it's not until the second generation that it really takes hold and thrives, which also can have some interesting kind of parallels to immigrant stories. And so I thought it was an apt symbol. And I didn't know any of that, and I don't think you need to know that to appreciate the plant's place in the film, but I think it does add some interesting things to think about there. So yeah, I thought that was really cool. As far as other things about this movie, I think I've said just about everything I wanted to. I mentioned the humor. There's one great sequence that has to do with his bedwetting. He has a problem where he's wetting the bed, and Grandma comments on it. And there's a couple great punchlines around it, and also plot points. So it's a part of the story. So I'm not going to spoil that, but that's another way that the humor just really works effectively in the story and is also very funny. But then... And by the way, if you haven't seen this, it doesn't make jokes at his expense about the bet wedding, which, you know, he's been through a lot. You can almost understand, you know, that's as I grew up and learned more about bedwetting in general, it tends to be around trauma and different things. So anyway, that's an interesting part of this. So it's kind of telling about his experiences as well. Yeah, that's an interesting part. But then the score, I think, is really, really strong. And it's, look up the composer's name. His name is Emil Mosseri, who I didn't recognize that name, but he has done the score for a few things that I've seen, including The Last Black Man in San Francisco from a few years back, which I love the score of that film as well. And then the Miranda July film Cajillionaire, the new one, he did the score for that as well, which that didn't stick out to me as much in that film. But now I'm going to go back and watch it and pay closer attention to the score there. But yeah, I think the score in Minari is really, really strong.
Yeah, I agree. I thought the score was really well done, and it wasn't overbearing on the film. Yeah. And I think it allowed a lot of space for the images to, you know, take control. But then when it was needed, it was present and it was really good. I think it fit the landscape as well.
I remember thinking, watching the movie, like, this kind of sounds like the band Grizzly Bear. That's an indie band that I used to really like a lot. And listening back to the score, just streaming, I was like, this does sound like Grizzly Bear. So I almost wondered, like, was this scored by Grizzly Bear? Because they did a couple of movies that they scored, but now he has no affiliation with that band. But yeah, that's kind of the vibe of the music here. And I think it's really great. Well, cool. I guess we can kind of wrap things up, unless you have anything else you want to bring up, Andrew?
I think... Yeah, there's one thing that I would like to say about, without giving anything away, the film sort of ends back at referencing to Minari. And it's sort of this return to something that has provided, in some way, a reprieve, but also this a bit of home, a bit of where they're from. I don't know, it sort of symbolizes to me this... family and then also memory. And I think it's really powerful. I think the film is well titled, and it ends in a way that feels like we've completed something, and we've sort of been privileged to see this family go through these early struggles of moving to a place in which there aren't many people like them. I think in the chicken sexting sort of factory area, there are a few Koreans there. And I do think there is something very interesting there where the mother asks, why hasn't a Korean church been built? And she's like, well, there's a reason people have moved away from the cities because they want to get away from the Korean church in some way. So the family, even though there are some Koreans in the area, they're trying to make their own way in America, in rural America, where they feel isolated. But this Minari and having the grandmother there, I think provides them some stability or something that brings them together, holds them together, and I guess symbolically. And I thought that was very powerful.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I really like that line too. And it's just so telling too that Monica, the mother, she's wanting that familiarity. She's wanting the Korean church, and finding that most of the Korean Americans here don't share her opinion in that. Yeah, that's an interesting touch. And I actually thought of one more thing that I thought was just really funny and quirky was that... the Mountain Dew situation. they drink a lot of Mountain Dew.
Yes.
It's just a funny thing that's also kind of ties into the grandma as well, because you see the kid drinking Mountain Dew and then the grandma says, what is this beverage you're drinking? And he says, oh, Dad says it's really healthy. It's water from the mountains. And I just thought that was really funny. And again, like she's observing this culture for the first time and they've kind of become used to it. It's just another funny observation in that, but yes. Yeah, the ending is really, really strong. And yeah, I think the title is brilliant. Like again, I didn't know what Minari was. And so I can't imagine it's commonly grown in Arkansas at all. Right. So it's a really unique part of their heritage that they're able to bring with them. Yeah. Great point. Well, that is Minari. You've seen it twice. Is that right?
I saw it twice. Yes. I wanted to see it a second time. Because I think there's a lot there, even though it's, I don't think it's like overfilled with like references or like anything heavy handed, but there's some nuanced performances that I wanted to focus on a little bit more in the family dynamics. And I definitely think it's worth like multiple viewings. Yeah. I think the second time around, I wanted to focus a bit more on the relationship between the man and woman and their like their relationship, and I thought that was really, really interesting. So
yeah, I'm anxious to watch it again. I've just seen it the once, but yeah, really strong. I hope it gets some awards attention. I'll be surprised if it doesn't. But there's a lot of good movies this year, so we'll see what happens. But all right, that's Minari. That is right now it's a VOD. Of course, it's really recent. So if you're listening in the future, I imagine it'll stream somewhere or become a cheaper online rental, but definitely worth watching. I think if you're an Arkansan, you'll connect with this. But even if you're not, you'll find a lot to like about Minari. All right. Thanks so much for joining me again today, Andrew. I hope to have you back again before too long, but this was a great discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Andrew for being here. It's always a pleasure to have him on the show. Well, next up on Arthouse Garage is the Oscars Reaction Special. The Oscars are this coming Sunday, April 25th, and I'm planning to get on the podcast with Rance Collins to break it all down. That should be out the following day on Monday, the 26th. I always planned Season 6 to end with the Oscars, and that's almost here. A little production note about this podcast. You may have noticed that I've been doing 2 films per episode for a few episodes now, and I'm going to try to keep that going. That will enable me to cover a greater variety of films on the show. Probably I'll keep doing series of films with a guest, like I've done with the Classic Film Starter Pack season, or the season on contemporary Asian filmmakers. I love covering older films and marathoning through a series of films, and trying to learn as much about great movies as I can, and kind of pass that knowledge along through the podcast. It's actually my favorite part of doing this. But I also really love covering new films, giving my review of things that are just hitting theaters, so that hopefully I can give listeners ideas about what's good to go and see, especially now that movie theaters are beginning to become a safe option again. All that is to say, I'm going to move away from the seasons model and instead continue doing an episode every 2 weeks, most likely featuring a newer film and an older film in each episode, with the older films being part of a series and the newer films being whatever strikes my fancy among new releases. So stay tuned for that. I'll try to give notice about what's coming up next on the podcast schedule. I'll announce the next marathon on next week's Oscar special, and I've got some exciting plans for down the road as well. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at www.appallingproductions.com or find the link in the show notes. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob-free.